where would the board on aging be? It would be in that area.
I'm here to talk to you about that today.
I know.
So this is good.
You can ask for the brain.
Aging and Adult Services.
If you have any amendments, we can.
There it is. This is the base.
Something about eliminate senior nutrition support grants.
The Health and Human Services Budget Division will come to order. Senator Lynch asked if she could take her bill up first because her witness needs to leave, and so we will do that. And that is Senate File 509.
Same thing twice.
Good morning.
Bills?
Chair Berglund, members, I should say member, Senator Fischbach. It is
we got one back there listening.
A pleasure to be here today and talk about Senate File 509. This bill is the focus of heart disease and stroke prevention. The Heart Disease and Stroke Prevention Unit within the Minnesota Department of Health is the only state-level public health program dedicated to combating heart disease and stroke prevention in Minnesota. Cardiovascular diseases are the leading cause of death in Minnesota, accounting for some 32% of all deaths in our state in 2004. The Heart Disease and Stroke Prevention Unit collects data that helps direct planning and research under the guidance of its steering committee, which includes respected public health experts, researchers, and physicians. The steering committee includes the gentleman to my right, Dr. Russell Liebker, who the Mayo Professor in Epidemiology at the University of Minnesota School of Public Health and is a volunteer with American Heart Association. In 2000, the unit was created from a grant from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC. It was created, in short, to create an action plan for our state. The plan's goals are to create infrastructure to promote cardiovascular health, prevent the development of risk factors of cardiovascular disease, detect and treat risk factors, prevent reoccurrence, disabilities, and deaths, and eliminate health disparities. The unit was funded almost exclusively by this grant, which expires this year. There is no guarantee that the CDC will be able to grant the request because the president's budget does not apparently include funding for grants to combat heart disease and strokes by the various states. I also think it's important to point out that while this is an opportunity, again, to focus on prevention in healthcare, I also think that any time that we can support collaborative and innovative relationships among various groups, that's good. And I'd like to point out that there are various partners that have been included in this unit, including various state governmental agencies, the American Heart Association, the Minnesota Stroke Association, the University of Minnesota School of Public Health, the state's Medicare Quality Improvement Organization, and the Mayo Clinic. And at this point, I would like to turn the program here over to Dr. Liebker, who will make some additional comments.
Thank you, Senator Lynch. Madam Chair, it's a pleasure to be here. As you've heard, I am a cardiologist at the University of Minnesota who happens to be in the Department of Medicine and the School of Public Health. But I've been a volunteer for the Heart Association for almost 30 years, and I've been a volunteer member of the steering committee of the Department of Health's Heart Disease and Stroke Prevention Unit. Now, heart disease is still, as you've just heard from Senator Lynch, the leading killer of Minnesotans, despite advances. I suspect most of you have friends, relatives who have suffered from this. One of the things people don't know, though, is that of the people that die of heart disease and stroke, two-thirds of them die out of hospital, outside of the hospital, at home, on the street, wherever. They are not able to benefit from the many life-saving things we can do in the hospital. And I tell a story about my dad. My dad was an executive, fairly high executive for Sears Roebuck in Chicago. And he had high blood pressure all his life, so high that when he was drafted in the military in 1942, he was excluded, a time when they didn't exclude young men from the military easily. He woke up one morning, age 51, told my mother he was feeling quite badly, and died. Two-thirds of Minnesotans die in similar circumstances, some home, some at the office. Their first event, because half of them don't know they have any problem, is their last one. And in that setting, prevention is, we think, the most effective strategy that we have. We also have AEDs, as I learned in the House committee, stationed around here to rescue people. But in fact, most people don't die near one. So there's a heart disease and stroke prevention unit at the Minnesota Department of Health. And as you've heard, it collects, interprets, and reports data on cardiovascular disease in Minnesota. I'm a member of that committee. We've developed a plan for cardiovascular disease prevention through a steering committee representing many elements in the state, including my own at University of Minnesota. We have been supported, or this group has been supported, I'm on it as a volunteer, by a planning grant from the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta, a federal agency. It has given modest funds for planning since 2000. We have been planning since 2000 for a program and waiting to apply for basic implementation. A number of states have implementation grants. We have not. This year we've been told there'll be no new implementation grants and there may be no planning grants anymore. Other states have both taken the CDC money and invested as well in this issue. And some, like Michigan, have no CDC grant, yet have developed an office with programs such as we have proposed. So we have a comprehensive action plan after years of meeting of volunteers with the staff. It focuses on working with businesses, schools, disadvantaged groups because of health disparities, professional groups, hospitals. It has a variety of well-laid-out methods, including screening, awareness, professional education, to try to help reduce these diseases in Minnesota, and a plan for monitoring the effects. So, in summary, we've been planning for 6 years. Other states have moved on with CDC or their own funds. And while certainly Minnesotans are healthier than other people are in some other states, there's still a lot to do. I think that the plans developed by the Department of Health are one important way to confront cardiovascular disease through prevention. So we're asking here for support, admittedly in the context of a reduced federal budget, but even if we're able to continue to get planning money, we need to take the next step forward. We have a plan. And I think it's a good one, and it's time to start implementing it. Thank you very much.
Senator Lynch, it would be good if the committee could kind of present a budget to us so that we would have a little better idea of how this $400,000 would be used.
The committee would be happy to do that.
Are there other questions? Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Lupker, is that correct?
Correct.
Are you doing any specific targeting towards females? It came out in the news this morning about females and heart disease, and I was wondering if you're spending a little more time on that.
You probably noticed my red dress button here for the red dress campaign, which mm-hmm. you may have heard about. Certainly, we know more women than men die of heart disease. They die somewhat older, but nonetheless, until recent years, it's been an undiscovered problem. And indeed, in our plan, we have put forward efforts to focus on women who frequently get missed in this.
Are there other questions? Okay, if not, Senator Lynch, we do have a quorum if you want to make your motion.
Thank you, Chair Berglund. With that, I would request that Senate File 509 be laid over for possible inclusion in the health omnibus bill.
You've heard the motion. Those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted. Thank you very much, Dr. Lupker. We're going to then, we have quite a number of boards that have change requests this year, and so we're going to try and do half of them today and half of them another day. So if you think it's too long, just remember we didn't put them all on today. so we'll start with Board of Chiropractic, Julie Vagnus. And maybe Mr. Godfrey can help us by pointing to the board page that we should be looking at.
Madam Chair, members, the board section begins, if you notice that you have these tabs here on your budget book, it's the second to the last tab labeled boards, and the chiropractic board is the first page of that section.
I have no tabs.
Oh.
Nobody has tabs. We have tabs. I have no tabs.
Oh, you don't.
I know, that's what I said.
Oh, dear.
Well, it's about this far down.
Okay.
Right. It's been the last 100 pages.
Optometry, are they alphabetic?
What page is it?
Do you have a page number?
Definitely a mistake. We're not picking on you, Senator.
They're alphabetic, aren't they? Yeah. Yes. So chiropractic board. I'm there.
Ms. Vagnus.
Madam Chair and representatives of the committee, my name is Julie Vangsness, and I'm representing the Board of Chiropractic Examiners. Their executive director, Larry Spicer, was unable to attend today. Basically, their budget, we are recommending, or the governor is recommending, an increase in their budget the first year to cover unanticipated costs of a retirement of a long-term state employee. Also, just a salary adjustment cost to cover the 3.25 of anticipated salary dollars anticipated over the next 2 years, and then also some operational money to cover costs of online processing for the credit cards and costs anticipated with contested case activity for investigations and expert witnesses. The total amount of their proposed increase is $36,000 in 2008 and $33,000 in 2009. Are there any questions?
Madam Chair, we're a little lost over here still. Well, here.
Pardon me? This is the actual like budget page is on page 4 of the of the board section. And I'm just looking over trying to see if these various items don't seem to be broken out on this page. So maybe you could get us a breakdown. How much is for retirement COLA?
The retirement payoff is $15,000 the first year. The operational costs to cover the online processing and investigation costs are $10,000 each year. And the salary increase of the anticipated 3.25 is $11,000 the first year and $23,000 the second year. And all of the funds here come from the state government special revenue fund, not the general fund.
Right.
And the board currently collects sufficient revenue to cover all of these increases and their current operational budget.
Okay. So that is helpful. Are there any questions? If not, thank you very much. Next, we'll go to Roberta Opheim, the ombudsperson for mental health and mental retardation.
Good morning. I'm Roberta Opheim, the ombudsman for mental health and developmental disabilities. The governor's budget that's in your book, and I'm not sure on which pages it's on, continues a status quo position of the agency, but does include some increases. The there is a deficiency request for 2007, which would then adjust to the base in future years, and the deficiency for this year that's some of the items that are contained within it are the retirement, again, of a longtime employee who's got a lot of vacation and sick leave accrued that has to be bought out. We have some office space that was being sublet by the Office of Ombudsman for Older Minnesotans, and they moved over to the Anderson Building. And the nursing contracts, which were larger than anticipated and included the back pay. So those are items that led to the deficiency as well as continuing inflation on a flatline budget over the past 4 years. The other items contained in the budget, we did make a request for $50,000 for our case management tracking system to finish it and update it so that it can give us better data and better information to analyze the services that we're providing. The governor did include that, but he didn't include it in the budget in front of this committee. He included it as a small agency grant in the Office of Enterprise Technology. And it's something that we're pleased because for a long time we've been asking for some small agency funds, and those have not been readily available. So the $50,000 is in that budget. And then the final item is the salary adjustment that was recommended by the governor for all agencies across the board to recognize some of the increases that we've been facing relative to the actual salaries and the increases in both salaries and benefits. With that, I would stand for any questions. Many of you are familiar with the work that we do, but if there are new individuals that would like some information about the services we provide, we're a direct service organization directly to the citizens of Minnesota.
Ms. Opheim, I'm going to ask you to do the same thing. I have found that the salary compensation, it's 26 and 53,
mm-hmm.
but then what portion of this increased request is for rent, did you say?
Oh, no.
What are we doing
The
here?
26 and the 56 are just the straight salary. I think it's...
Right, I said that. Now I'm trying to figure out what the rest of it is.
Okay, it's 66 to maintain current services and to deal with the deficiency. The deficiency in rent from what DHS was paying us works out to be about $24,000 a year because we're on under lease for that. We investigated a number of different opportunities to reduce that, but the building we're in, the landlord isn't likely to want to renegotiate the lease because the building's quite empty and many state agencies have left. It's Metro Square. We looked at moving into a state-owned building, which would have allowed us to terminate our lease. State-owned property was, there
so
was time, none.
I'm just going to interrupt you then so I can further clarify the question. So the difference between the $24,000 per year, which is your deficiency in rent, and the $66,000 and the $106,000, the rest of that is for travel and other operating costs?
Yes.
Okay. Are there any other questions?
Currently, I would mention, just to clarify, that of our current appropriation that's been stagnant over the last 4 years, three budget items take up 99% of that: salaries, rent, and telephones. So we have been forced to operate with a 1% to meet all the other expenses, which is what accumulated into the deficiency.
Are there any other questions? Now, thank you very much. Next, we'll ask Muriel Gabasta, the ombudsperson for Spanish-speaking families. And Mr. Godfrey, if you can help us find that page.
That one's just next.
Madam Chair, members, the ombudsperson for families page is just the next section over from the ombudsman for mental health.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Muriel Gabasta, and I am with the Office of Ombudsperson for Families, and I work with Minnesota's Spanish-speaking families. As you know, we were contacted by your assistant, Shannon Anderson, just with respect to the governor's recommendation for our compensation adjustment for fiscal year 2008 and fiscal year 2009 for our general fund, which would be approximately $6,000 in fiscal year 2008 and the recommendation of an increase of $6,000 for fiscal year 2009. And we agree that that will be very helpful to our agency, which does already operate on a very slim budget. It will help us with the recommended 2% to 3.25% increase for most Minnesota agencies. About 75% of our budget goes to our salary slash compensation, and the other 25% goes to operating expenses. One of the things that I would like to mention to you is that when the Office of Ombudsperson for Families was initially created in 1990 or 1991, our compensation was structured based on our office being a part of the different councils, the Councils on Black Minnesotans, the Chicano Latino Affairs Council. We have since been removed from them, and we are independent and separate from them, and we feel as though our agency's budget is not on par, and it should be equalized with that of the other state ombuds offices.
So the governor's recommendation is just for compensation increase for your agency?
Yes, it is.
Are there any questions? Now, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Joan Wilshire with the Disability Council. And Mr. Godfrey, if you can help us find the page.
Madam Chair, members, the Disability Council pages are found one section before the Ombudsman for Mental Health section. So it's about 10, 15 pages back.
Good morning, Madam Chair, Senate members. My name is Joan Wilshire. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota State Council on Disability. And I've handed out to you this morning, hot off the press, our annual report for 05-06 fiscal year. And you can certainly look at that as I just talk briefly about the Council on Disability. Thank you for inviting us this morning to talk about our agency and about the governor's recommendation to permanently remove our sunset provision in state statute. As many of you may or may not know, Minnesota State Council on Disability is one of the five state councils that exist to advise the governor, state legislature, and state agencies on the, and the public regarding disability issues. And we are actually almost one of the oldest councils since having been created in 1973, and currently are only one of the few councils that have a sunset provision left in their statute. One of the things that we you will see when looking through our annual report, we receive over 10,000 contacts a year contacting our agency regarding disability issues. We provide a variety of services to customers, you know, ranging from building code access, disability parking, to a variety of training needs and so forth. Many accomplishments have been made, ranging from working on our annual report, our annual meeting with annual awards luncheon, town hall meetings, and some most significant accomplishments have been in regard to our collaboration and coordinating with other state agencies, such as the Pathways to Employment Project with Department of Human Services and DEED, and working on our also the prevention of secondary disabilities with the Department of Health. And so these are just a few of our great accomplishments. Which brings us to why we're here today to talk about the elimination of our sunset provision. The governor has recommended this that our council permanently remove the sunset provision, and that is due to the fact that we are working very hard on our issues, and I think he sees value in what we do and are looking at what we do in our mission. And as we look forward to the removal of our sunset, this will actually allow us to spend more time on what our consumers are asking us to do and become more productive with our staff, focusing on producing better outcomes. Efficiency will certainly be increased, and morale and so forth will be increased as well. So by permanently removing the sunset language in our provision and our statute, we'll also ensure that our base funding will continue without having to go through all the steps we now go through every 4 years to make sure that we continue. And, of course, this will allow us to just continue to serve the community of people with disabilities. And just so you know, next year we will be celebrating our 35th anniversary of existence, and we are thrilled. So we'll hopefully have a wonderful celebration, and we'll include you all in that. Do you have any questions?
Ms. Wilshire, is there anything in here besides your base and then a compensation adjustment?
No, Madam Chair.
And then is there a reason why your other operating costs go down over what they were in 06-07?
Why they went down in 06?
No, they go down in 08-09 over 06-07 by about half.
We've purchased some of recently we've upgraded our computer systems, Madam Chair and Senate members, and so some of our costs will not be increasing in that particular area.
Okay, and then you also had in 06-07 some kind of miscellaneous special revenue that's no longer being continued.
Madam Chair, Senate members, that revenue, to my knowledge, was based on some of the grant. I believe that would be some of the grants that we received from the Otto Bremer Foundation,
okay.
A one-time grant.
All right. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you, committee members.
Next, we'll call on Marshall Schrag from the Board of Dentistry. And this will be
somewhere in
what page under the boards, Mr. Godfrey?
Well, Madam Chair, members, the Board of Dentistry has found one section past the chiropractors board, which is about 15 pages further into your budget book.
Okay.
Madam Chair, Senators, thank you for this opportunity. I'm Marshall Schrag, the Executive Director of the Board of Dentistry. The increases in the dentistry budget for 08-09, per the Governor's recommendations, involve two things. One is operational increases of $10,000 per year, and the other have to do with the compensation adjustments. We're looking at $10,000 per year in operational adjustments, $22,000 for compensation adjustments in 08, $44,000 in compensation adjustments for 09. The $10,000 per year in operational increases, as you'll hear from my colleagues, has to do with an accounting practice that up until recently the online credit card fees were paid or were accounted for as an indirect fee or an indirect cost, and starting in biennium in the fiscal year 08, those will become direct costs, and so those will come out of the direct count, the direct fees or direct costs of the boards, and so we're moving that and requesting additional operating costs to offset those. Also, you'll hear from my colleagues that that we do bring in enough fees from our licensees to cover those costs within our current fee structure. And I'll answer any questions if you have them.
So are there any questions? I don't know if you can answer this question, but how many of these boards are moving to this credit card processing system and therefore have an additional need for revenue to get that up and going?
I believe that's universal among the 16 health-related boards.
Is that correct, Julie?
Well, that, not all of them are asking for money for it, so.
13? I'm told 13 of the boards.
13 of the boards. I guess maybe what we'll do is get a list of those so we'll know which ones they are. Are there any other questions for the Board of Dentistry? If not, thank you very much. The next is Robert Leash with the Medical Practices Board.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Robert Leach. I'm the Executive Director of the State Board of Medical Practice. We have two change items in our budget for the next biennium. One,
maybe we can find this page before you get too far along
sure.
here.
Madam Chair, members, the pages now for the boards are in alphabetical order. So if you just turn to, it's about 15, 20 pages into the board section under Medical Practice Board.
Okay, thank you. Continue.
The first change item in the governor's recommended budget is the compensation adjustment of $51,000 in fiscal year 2008 and $105,000 in 2009. This adjustment is to account for changes in salary, insurance rates, pension plans, and things like that. Our other increase is $500,000 in fiscal year 2008 to cover increased contested case costs. Since 2004, the medical board has prosecuted a number of contested cases against licensees and disciplinary matters. One of those cases has presented a significant strain on our resources, costing the board approximately $1.5 million to date. That case has not yet been completed, and we do not anticipate that case being completed in the next 2 years. So there will continue to be significant costs associated with this case as well as other cases that are currently pending. And that is the reason for our request for an additional $500,000 in 2008. That's about all I have. I'll be happy to answer any questions the committee may have.
Madam Chair.
Senator Pretner-Solon.
Madam Chair, and I'm sorry I missed your name.
Robert Leach.
Dr. Leach?
Mr.
Leach, does your budget doesn't come from the general fund, does it? Is it
special revenue? All these boards, well, not quite all of them, but most of them are special revenue
through licensing fees.
Most of them.
Okay. That's correct.
Mr. Leach, does the board have an advertising budget? Is advertising part of your base budget?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, no, we do not have a budget for advertising per se. We do expend a certain amount of our resources for public outreach activities to let the public know that there is a place that they can go if they have problems with a healthcare professional that we regulate. For 6 years, I don't know if you're aware, for 6 years we had a booth at the Minnesota State Fair in the Education Building where we handed out pamphlets and answered questions about people who had problems with their physicians and other healthcare providers. We determined this year that we had pretty much reached our demographic at the Education Building at the State Fair. It was the same people coming back year after year. And so the board decided that they would take out public service announcements on Minnesota Public Radio to invite individuals to visit our website. The cost associated with both of those activities is approximately $20,000 per year.
The reason I'm asking you about this is because someone I know saw one of your outreach efforts. And but one of the things they noticed is that in that outreach effort, you didn't have very much information about how to actually contact the board or what the board does.
Senator Berglund, I don't know what you're referring to. At our booth at the State Fair, we handed out...
I'm referring to the Minnesota Public Radio outreach.
We're only allowed a 15-second soundbite with our Minnesota Public Radio activities. And that's just about enough time to give a website that people can go to our website and learn more about our activities.
Any other questions, Senator?
Madam Brian? Chair, Mr. Leach. So your board is receiving all public money then, being as fees or...
Madam Chair, Senator Koning, all of our money comes from our licensing fees, okay. The fees that we charge the individuals that we regulate. We receive no general fund dollars.
Okay. Now, and Madam Chair,
Senator Koning,
does the board have a lobbying arm of your board that lobbies on behalf of the board, or
Senator Koning? No, we do not have a lobbyist as such. No. Okay. We do not pay a lobbyist. The assistant executive director, Dr. Richard Auld, conducts much of our legislative activities, but he's not a paid lobbyist. He's a staff member.
Okay. So is the intent of the board to be lobbying members of the Senate and the House, or what is the intent of the board?
Senator Koning, I don't know what you're talking about.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, I don't.
If you're talking about the board's activities in response to legislation that comes up that the board either supports or opposes, yes, board staff will handle that on behalf of the board and contact individual legislators to let them know the board's opinion on any particular issue.
Okay. And then, Madam Chair, the board takes an opinion then on specific legislation and then relays their opinion to the legislature.
Senator Koning, oftentimes they do, yes.
I see. Okay. Thank you.
Can I add to that?
Absolutely.
Yeah. If the board has a reason to either support or oppose a particular piece of legislation they feel is either in the public protection would not be in the best interest of public protection, they will take a position on that legislation.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
And what is the volume of complaints that you receive each year?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that varies anywhere between 800 and 1,200 complaints a year.
And you're able, with the staffing level you have, to investigate all of those complaints?
Madam Chair, yes, we do. Every jurisdictional complaint that comes to our office receives a full investigation.
Any other questions? No, thank you. Randy Snyder from the Nursing Home Administrators Board. I think that's the next one in your book.
That's the second.
Good
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'll give you a second to find that budget. As soon as you find it, I'll probably be done with my report. So the only item that we're looking at is the governor's recommended compensation adjustment, and that's literally the only item that we're here for. So I stand for any questions you might have. I might add that Ben Ha, the Nursing Home Administrators Board, also is the fiscal agent for the Administrative Services Unit, which is the business office function for all the boards. That's Julie Vagsness as the lead budget officer that you heard from earlier. We also do the contracts, the HR, the IT, the purchasing, all the fiscal responsibilities in a centralized business role. So I'm the lead agency for that group as well.
And maybe you could just give, we have a lot of new members on this committee, you could just give us a little bit of an idea of what the Nursing Home Administrators Board does.
We license, we're probably the only federally required board for every skilled nursing home facility in the state of Minnesota and nationally. If you receive Medicare and Medicaid funds, you must have a licensed nursing home administrator. Each state is allowed to determine what the requirements are, the educational, academic, and training requirements that there are. So we establish those initial training requirements and maintain continued competency for administrators as well. We review about 120 complaints a year relating to administration of long-term care facilities, and right now it's only skilled facilities. Nationally, assisted living is a growing area, and about 47 states regulate the administrators of those sites. We do not in Minnesota.
Okay, any questions? No, thank you very much.
Madam Chair, I do have a question.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Snyder, do you have to date any nursing homes that share administrators?
Correct. This was legislation that we introduced in, that was passed in 2001, and there are 28 facilities that do share administrators. And we looked at that especially in rural facilities, that they needed one talented person to perhaps be shared between two sites. It's a cost savings measure. It does have its challenges, but I think it's been very effective legislation. And most of those are predominantly rural, outstate Minnesota.
Any other questions? If not, thank you very much, Mr. Snyder.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Next, we'll call on Robert Butler with the Marriage and Family Therapy Board. And as we go back to the M's.
Should be right. Medical.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Robert Butler, Executive Director of the Board of Marriage and Family Therapy. This should be rather simple, minor, small numbers. But we have two different change items. One is the governor's compensation adjustment, which amounts to $3,000 in fiscal year 2008 and $6,000 in 2009. The other item is a retirement payout of $17,000, and I would beg that you look at that very favorably, as it happens to be mine. Are there any questions?
Any questions? If not, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next, we'll take Cody Weiberg with the Board of Pharmacy.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Cody Weiberg. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Pharmacy. And we have several items this time around. One is a salary supplement, which in fiscal year 2008 would be $38,000. In fiscal year 2009 would be $41,000. The next is a proposal for new positions, one pharmacy inspector, who is a pharmacist, and one clerical position. That's $170,000 in fiscal year 2008, $176,000 in fiscal year 2009. One is a small agency base increase for $26,000 in fiscal year 08 and $53,000 in fiscal year 09. That is to cover, among other things, the cost for the online renewals that you heard of before. And in our case, we have equipment, including computers and our fax machine, that are pretty much outdated and need to be replaced. We're also in the process of still implementing our online services, and we anticipate we'll need to put some more money into that. And finally, in fiscal year 2009, I actually have three inspectors who qualify for retirement now. Two of them have told me that they don't plan to, but there's a possibility that the third one will retire. Just by way of comments, in terms of the salary supplement, I've been with the board for about 18 months, but my understanding is that the board has not had salary supplements approved for the last three bienniums. The board responded by doing a number of things. Excuse me, first of all, by not replacing a half-time clerical staff member who resigned in 2005, and then last year we laid off a full-time clerical staff person. In addition, one of my pharmacy surveyors has voluntarily dropped to 75% time, and we've taken other cost savings measures, including no longer mailing out copies of the board's newsletter, reducing the number of full board meetings, and reducing the amount we spend on the purchase of office supplies. The option at this point would be to cut further positions, and at this point my clerical staff is stretched to the breaking point, so that would be a inspector, undoubtedly, which is really not a good option because since 1996 the number of licensed facilities requiring inspections has increased by about 30%, but the number of inspectors has remained unchanged. And in addition, new technologies such as automated counting devices and new delivery systems such as telepharmacy are actually increasing the amount of time that needs to be spent on each inspection. That leads into the next item, which is concerning new positions. After I came on board, I did a bit of an analysis, and it turns out that fewer than half of licensed facilities are inspected annually by the board at this point. And we do focus on those facilities with which we've had some past concerns, but even the best of facilities, I think, can benefit from some of the educational efforts the inspectors make when they go out and inspect facilities. The number of licenses that we issue, both for individuals and facilities, has been also increasing steadily, and that's put some pressure on the board's clerical staff. Again, we're in the process of converting over to a new online licensing system, which will help with renewals, but much of the new licensing that we do involves review of credentials, and that involves manual processing of paperwork. As I mentioned, the small agency budget increase is operational costs, mostly along the online services and replacement of equipment. And I already mentioned the retirement. Finally, we believe that we will not have to increase any licensing fees during the biennium, but it's likely that an increase will be necessary next biennium, but by then it will have been nearly a decade since the last fee increases for the Board of Pharmacy. And with that, I'll take your questions.
Mr. Weiberg, you indicated that there's been a 30% increase in facilities that you inspect. You inspect pharmacies, right?
Madam Chair,
we inspect something else besides pharmacies.
Yes, we do. We inspect pharmacies, we inspect licensed drug wholesalers, and we inspect registered controlled substance researchers.
So what is causing the increase? We keep being told that we're losing pharmacies.
Mm-hmm. The largest amount of increase is in licensed controlled substance researchers. However, the state is not losing pharmacies in terms of licensed pharmacies. The state is actually gaining pharmacies. But if you take a look at the numbers, where the loss is being seen is in rural areas among independent pharmacies. There is a definite loss, particularly over the last 3 or 4 years, in rural independent pharmacies. And to some extent, that has been compensated by the fact that some of the regional and national chains have been moving out into the outstate area, but they tend to go into regional population centers like Wilmer or even Red Wing, where I live. What is being lost are the pharmacies in small towns of 2,000, 3,000 people. But the overall number of pharmacies statewide has been increasing.
Okay. That's good to know, I guess. Any other questions? Senator Prettner-Solon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Weiberg, can you tell me if the cancer drug recycling program has gotten underway, and has that increased the staffing pattern?
Madam Chair, Senator Prettner-Solon, it is underway. All the forms have been prepared. I have to tell you, though, that there have only been two hospitals that have signed up to participate in the program, Hennepin County Medical Center and Methodist at this point. I don't know at this point how much business they're doing or how much returns that they're getting. It has not added significantly to the amount of staff time. There was a bit of time spent, obviously, developing the paperwork, so there's been upfront costs, but not ongoing costs with that.
Senator Prettner-Solon.
Mr. Weiberg, how are people notified about the program? Because I keep talking to the pharmacies and the hospitals in my district, and they say, well, we keep waiting to hear. They haven't heard anything yet about it. And I'm just wondering how the word gets out that they can participate.
Madam Chair, Senator Prettner-Solon, we did put something in the newsletter, which is no longer mailed out, but it is available online. We have information online that people can go to. We have not, I guess, done a specific mailing about it. It's something that we might be able to, would consider doing, but we have put it in our newsletter. Unfortunately, even when we mailed the newsletter out, we would often hear from pharmacists that they didn't know about something that was in the newsletter. So, you know, I'm not sure that every pharmacist out there, unfortunately, reads our newsletter.
Okay.
Senator Rosen?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Weiberg, very interesting comment about the rural pharmacists and pharmacies that we're losing them. And I would say that I represent a district with many small towns, and several pharmacies have closed in those small towns, which is just about as bad as losing a school. And it wasn't necessarily because they weren't able to make it. I mean, our base out there is older people.
Mm-hmm.
And so the business was good. It was that there wasn't anybody coming in online or coming up to take the business. Nobody wants to work in a small town pharmacy with those hours. Is the board doing anything to address that? Are they helping the association? Is there some kind of influence that you can do to help this situation, because it is dire out there?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, the board, at least indirectly, is doing one thing, and that is the legislature several years ago approved a program to offer loan forgiveness to pharmacy students, and that money comes from us and goes to the health department. And in fact, I personally know one pharmacist who got one of those grants, although she didn't tell me she even applied for it until after she got it, and that's my oldest daughter. And she actually went down to work in St. James. So I guess I'm personally contributing by having my daughter work in a rural pharmacy. We do work with the association on these issues. I've had discussions with the folks at the health department. The board's primary role is to protect the health and safety of the public, and access is certainly potentially a safety issue. One of the things that we're trying to do, and the board in May of this year had a retreat to look at all the various proposals that are coming to us for alternative delivery systems, including telepharmacies. So we've established guidelines for telepharmacies. We don't think that's the best thing. We think a pharmacist in a pharmacy is the best thing anywhere, but we recognize that there may be some towns because of cuts in Medicare Part D reimbursement and because of students, even with the loan forgiveness program, being unwilling to go out and work in a rural area, that just aren't going to get a replacement pharmacist. So we've been working to develop guidelines for that, to try to keep pharmacy services in the smaller towns, but to try to do it as safely as possible.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Dyer is my constituent. I'll stop by.
Senator Sharon.
Would you say more about the automated systems that are being developed to dispense medications, how they work? Have you tried them, and where in some of these rural communities, and what your experience is with that?
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, there are a number of different automated systems. They range anywhere from what's essentially a robotic counting machine all the way up to vending-type machines where people can get a limited supply of medications stocked into a vending machine. Those are typically found in emergency rooms or urgent care centers. Because there's a limited number of drugs you can put in the cabinet, they tend to be things like antibiotics and pain relievers that people might need acutely. And it ranges all the way up to, I was just at the Veterans Hospital, I've also been down to Mayo. They have automated dispensing machines that take up an area many times the size of this room that will process hundreds of prescriptions an hour. So there's a wide variety of them. In the rural areas, the most common type that's used is probably just the robotic counting machine. That it speeds up the process a little bit. When the prescription is typed into the system, the command goes back to the counting machine to literally fill a vial, label the vial, and it comes off a conveyor belt for the pharmacist to check. That's the most common one, I think, used in rural settings now. What's increasingly happening are the telepharmacies, and in this case, there's a central pharmacy that's connected by a two-way audiovisual link to a remote site. The remote site typically has a technician but no pharmacist. It has a stock of drugs just like a regular pharmacy would have, and the technician is filling the prescription and then holding it under a camera and showing the pharmacist at the other end that this is the right drug, these are the right directions on the label. And then there's an area set aside with a separate camera where the pharmacist can do counseling and talk to the patient. So there's really a variety of systems out there.
And members, just so you haven't forgotten, this and a number of other loan forgiveness programs were proposed by the Department of Health, both the base and the tails to be refinanced out of the Healthcare Access Fund. So it's one of the things that we're looking for general fund money to provide for. Originally, in a couple of areas, we used surplus dollars that were in the special revenue accounts of the particular board for whom the profession was seeking loan forgiveness. But that was not intended to be a permanent solution. Are there other questions for Mr. Weiberg? If not, thank you very much. Then we're done with today's list of boards, and so we'll move on to the remaining bills that we have. And our next author is Senator Moa, and she is here with Senate File 343.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for an opportunity to come before you to present Senate File 343. Senate File 343 is asking for an appropriation from the general fund to Ramsey County for the Mother's First program. For over 10 years, Ramsey County's Mother's First program has served substance abusing pregnant women. The objectives of the Mothers First program are to provide a quality continuum of care and to serve as a link between unrelated systems to help clients refocus away from substance abuse and toward the health of their unborn child. The goal is to help women deliver chemically free, healthy babies. Mothers First provides early identification, prevention, intervention, and assessment services through the utilization of a multidisciplinary team to ensure an individualized continuum of care. The program is designed to reduce maternal chemical use, improve the health of mothers and newborn children, prevent subsequent child neglect and abuse, connect mothers with support in the community. They use the following strategies to achieve these program goals. They have case management through a multidisciplinary team. They support mothers by partnering with existing community agencies to coordinate chemical dependency treatment, relapse prevention, prenatal care, housing, child care, transportation, family medical care, mental health, parenting skill development, and education or vocational services. The program also provides support group and aftercare services for postpartum women. The project staffing consists of a public health nurse, two social workers, two chemical health specialists, a case aide, and a clerk. The public health nurse assures the mothers that the mothers have a prenatal care provider and are receiving prenatal care regularly. In addition, the nurse monitors the mother's well-being and encourages her to prepare for labor and delivery and parenting. And with the use of the fetal heart monitor, Mothers First promotes prenatal bonding. The chemical health specialist completes the Rule 25 assessments, refers to, the mothers to treatment, facilitates group support and education on a weekly basis, and encourages, develops, and supports healthy living lifestyle changes. The social worker provides case management services, referrals, assists with housing, maternity clothes, baby items, and a variety of other things. And finally, the case aide provides transportation for group and provides child care during the group therapy. She also supports the rest of the team on a variety of tasks. All staff do home visits, family meetings, one-to-one guidance, assistance with accessing community services, and transportation to medical, mental health, housing, and other appointments, and of course also assists with any urine analysis testing that is needed. Madam Chair and members, up until this year, this program had been operating with federal funds. Unfortunately, in 2007, the funds were eliminated. We need to continue to do this good work that this program provides, and that is why I am here today to ask for your support of Senate File 343. I have with me today Ramsey County Commissioner Tony Carter, who is going to share with us a little bit on the outcomes of the program and to answer specific questions. And then we have also with us Lori Markey, who is a beneficiary of the program, who would like to share with you her experience in the program.
Thank you very much, Senator Moore. Thank you, Senator Berglund, and members
Welcome,
of the committee.
Commissioner Carter.
Thank you
for being here today.
It's really good to be here. I apologize for rushing through. I'm sandwiched between a couple of meetings at the county, one of which we have special guests here for, so it may be that I need to leave even prior to the completion of our testimony. But I'm really glad to be able to share some of the outcomes of the program and then a few additional comments about our need for your assistance. From July of 2005 to June of 2006, 100 pregnant women were served through the program, and 83 children were born to Mothers First case-managed clients. 9 of the mothers, or 11%, tested positive for drugs at the time of the birth of their baby. Now, this is down from 23% the previous year. 8 babies, or 10%, tested positive for drugs or alcohol, and this is down from 21% in the previous year. So the program has been continually succeeding in improving the lives and of mothers and babies. And of the 90 women whose Mother's First case was closed during the year, 12 were reunited with a child who had been in foster care. 6 of the mothers served who were involved in child protection had their child protection cases closed while they were involved in Mother's First. 12 of those mothers were employed at program exit. At the time of entry, 82% of these women had been unemployed. 70% of the women had other children. 93% of the women had incomes below the poverty line, and nearly half of the women who had been served also had been previously criminally involved. So those are some of the outcomes and nuances of the program. What I really want to focus on is the fact that this program is unique in that it allows us to work with women prior to their entering chemical dependency treatment. The engagement is voluntary, and the engagement includes home visits, support and education groups, connecting these women with community resources that can help them in the communities in which they're living, and encouraging them to enter treatment voluntarily. The program does receive referrals from mandated reporters, some of whom include doctors and social workers and community organizations and child protection workers from the county. But again, many mothers who have heard of the success of the program contact us directly because they want the good outcomes that the program has been able to achieve for the mothers that they have known and also for their children. The model has been successful with many mothers who have been involved in chemical dependency treatment and have not previously had success. They also meet other women who have had or who have been in similar circumstances through this program, and they learn that they're not alone, and they learn that they can achieve success as others have, and then they are able to become mentors to other women. So beyond the statistics that you've heard about babies who are born without toxins, we want you to know that there are other strong indicators of the success of the program. Women who have been a part of it, who have delivered their babies, and who are finished with the core services of Mothers First actually continue to come back and participate in the program. And they receive help. They help others, and they also receive help in maintaining a sober lifestyle and in taking care of their children. They come back and let staff know when they're having difficulties, and they can receive some short-term assistance with issues that they're struggling through. Now, the Minnesota Department of Human Services has provided us funding from federal chemical dependency dollars through 2005. But then we were notified that these funds were intended only to be used for mothers after they enter chemical dependency treatment. And that service is direly needed after chemical dependency treatment. But waiting until after delays our engagement with these mothers for several months. And in essence, each additional month that it takes for them to become engaged, each additional month that it takes for them to cease their drug use is an additional month and a more difficult process of moving away from drugs. The Department of Human Services has provided a grant to Mothers First to expand our services again after a mother becomes involved in treatment. And we are very, very thankful for that because that is also needed, but it still leaves us struggling, trying to maintain this essential service, doing the outreach to mothers early, and ensuring that we continue to accomplish the success with them, helping them to increase their positive outcomes, and even more importantly, to increase positive outcomes for babies born chemical-free. So that is the assistance we are asking you for. I thank you for your time, and I have to apologize to Lori because I would love to hear your testimony. Lori has been involved in Mothers First and will be able to share with you her experience and the importance of the program. Senator Mulan.
Commissioner, before you run off, I just have a kind of a quick question for you, and that is, in listening to your testimony, I got the impression that you serve 100 clients per year, is it?
In this
100 mothers per year?
That is the number of mothers that were served in the program in 2005. I believe that's where the numbers were coming from. Correct.
And so then the cost per client is about $2,250.
That sounds correct. Now, I would ask if there has been a reduction in the number of mothers served since the cuts were experienced. And Dave Haley is here, who can take over for me. Okay.
I just have a few financial questions to ask, and I just want to make sure, somebody was here to answer them before you left, Commissioner. So go ahead. That's okay.
Madam Chair, in response to your question, it's about $5,000 a year is what it costs to provide the service.
And that is just for the outreach effort, does not include treatment, or you're getting,
Madam Chair,
you're getting
members,
federal funds for the treatment portion?
Madam Chair, for the entire program, the outreach and the treatment program, it's $5,000 a year.
And so what part of that then is for the outreach that you're not eligible to receive federal funding for?
Madam Chair, I'm going to step back. It's $5,000 per family, and what we're attempting to do is the majority of the families that we had been serving were ones that we reached before they went into treatment. And what the feds have provided and what DHS is providing for us is funding to serve families once they get to treatment. And so it's, in essence, a different population. And so what we're asking for is
to continue. It's the same person, isn't it? It's the same family.
About half the families end up in treatment. Mothers end up in treatment once they come to the program. So you're right. In terms of the money that this DHS would provide us, there would be about a 50% overlap. But we're still trying to reach that 50% of folks who are in the program, and don't ever end up in treatment because they end up moving off of chemicals without an inpatient treatment program.
And do they do this, would it be considered then kind of an outpatient treatment?
Madam Chair, correct.
And federal funds are not available for outpatient treatment, only inpatient treatment?
Madam Chair, the money that the DHS had provided to us came from a funding stream, and I can't tell you exactly what the funding stream was, but it was designed, what the feds have said is it's only designed to provide services to families after they enter treatment.
After they enter treatment, regardless of whether it's inpatient or outpatient.
Correct.
So I guess what we're looking for, and maybe you don't have this today, but we'd like a breakdown of the cost per family per year of the treatment component versus the outreach and support component after they leave the treatment.
Madam Chair, and members, it seems this is a... maybe we'll let Ms. Markey testify to her experience in the program. Perhaps I'll give you a little bit more detail to the program, because I don't know if they could really break apart the treatment from the outreach component of it. So why don't we let Ms. Markey testify, and then we can answer
So I'd like
questions.
To hear from her. Thank you for coming today.
All right, thank you. I'm very nervous and
yes, don't
excited
be nervous.
To be able to...
Remember one thing when you're up at that table. You pay our salary, so we work for you.
Right. You got it. All right. One of the things I keep my name is Lori Markey. I am a former participant of the Ramsey County Mothers First Program and now currently are on their board, on their advisory board. I'd like to say in regards to the whole notion of contacting families before they enter treatment, that piece for myself was a critical component because it was the Ramsey County Mothers First program that got me into an extended inpatient treatment, which was what I needed when I was pregnant with my daughter. And without their involvement, I probably wouldn't have made it to a treatment program that was appropriate for me. Many of the Rule 25 funded programs that people are going to are what we as addicts and recovering people call the 10-day spin dry. And that's all too often not efficient. It doesn't give people who have spent most of their lives acquiring a lifestyle centered around using the opportunity to change certain behavior patterns and attitudes to the extent that it's going to keep them clean when they leave. I attended a 60-day program under threat of commitment from the Ramsey County Mothers First program. And I was almost 6 months pregnant with my daughter when they said, you know, either you go do this or we're going to have you committed. And they were talking about a program for a year. And it was that got me to agree to go to an extended inpatient treatment for 60 days was supposed to be the appropriated time. And I ended up doing 78 days. Because I didn't have a safe place to go. And I had realized by then that if I had left early, or if I had not been in treatment for a sufficient amount of time, I wouldn't have realized that, I don't have a safe place to go where I know that I'm not going to use. You know, I guess having that support and having somebody on my daughter's side to say, you know, you're not doing what you need to be doing right now, and we're going to make sure that you do it. You know, if for no other reason than to make sure that she's born healthy and that she's born clean. You know, and the side benefit to that was me getting clean and actually wanting to stay clean after battling, you know, through many treatments and many periods of sobriety, you know, spanning 5 years, losing custody of my son and getting him back. And being able to go to court and say, you know, I don't want him, his school, you know, his schooling disrupted anymore, and I'd like to have him come home when the school is complete, and having the judge say, no, he needs to be home with you now. And, you know, it was, I remember being in court on a Wednesday, and she said, I want this complete on Friday. She said, you have till Friday to get this done. He needs to be with his mother. And, to have both of my kids home, and now I'm still involved when I can be with Mothers First, and doing many things with my life that I never would have even imagined that I could do. I'm currently in college and will be graduating from my associate program in May, transferring into a bachelor program over at Metro State. It's been an absolutely amazing course that my life has turned directly because of the Mothers First program. And they're not able to do what I know and what I've experienced that they can do because there's no funding. And it's pretty sad that if one family, if they only get one family to be as successful as my family has been, and in turn those what my children hopefully will be because of the Mothers First involvement, then that it's worth it. It's worth the money. You know, it just is.
Tell us about your daughter. Was she born healthy?
Oh, yeah, my daughter. She was born free of drugs, and surprisingly enough, they say that the meconium, which is the baby's first stool, can be tested back 6 months, and traces of chemicals can be found in their system. And I stopped using just before I was 6 months along with her, and her meconium was clean. So I thought that was pretty amazing. I thought, okay, well, we know she's going to be clean, but they're going to find it in her, you know, in her first stools, and I thought, how sad. She was good, and God, both of my children are a total blessing, and so am I, and so are many families that are able to get clean and stay clean, and unfortunately, not all of us do.
Thank you so much, Ms. Markey, for being willing to come and tell your story. And you did a great job. You had nothing to be nervous about. You have a wonderful story to tell us. Are there questions for her? If not, again, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Questions for Senator Moa or any of her witnesses?
Madam Chair. I apologize. I'm the chief author of the bill from the legislative auditor's office with respect to the
yes. Well, we did notice.
Yes,
We're trying to fix those when we see them.
Well, anyways, I didn't think to do an amendment, but I know that council has drafted language to help me clean up my own bill. So, Madam Chair, if you don't mind, I would like to have that done to my bill.
Okay. Senator Coring will move the amendment, and can the staff read it for us?
Sure. On page 1, line 2, delete the Mothers First and insert A. And then on line 7 and 8, delete to Ramsey County for the Mothers First program and insert to the Commissioner of Human Services for for the purposes of a program in Ramsey County that provides early intervention efforts designed to discourage pregnant women from using alcohol and illegal drugs.
Could you just read that one more time, Mr. Gill?
Sure. On line 2, delete the mother's first and insert A. And then on line 7 and 8, delete to Ramsey County for the mother's first program. And insert to the Commissioner of Human Services for the purposes of a program in Ramsey County that provides early intervention efforts designed to discourage pregnant women from using alcohol and illegal drugs.
Any questions on that amendment? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Now, are there further questions? Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Bois, just a quick question. Are all these referrals mandated, or are some of the our participants voluntary?
Madam Chair and Senator Rosen, the some of the participants are referred to the program by mandated reporters. So if they went to a clinic to get prenatal care and let's say in their UA the doctor finds that, the doctors will make a referral. But participation in this portion of the program is purely voluntary.
Madam Chair?
Senator Rosen.
Senator, when you're in the program, then you will have a drug test after your child is born. Is that required?
Madam Chair and Senator Rosen, I'll refer that to Mr. Haley. Is that correct?
That is correct.
That's great. Madam Chair, I think this is a great program, and congratulations on your success.
Thank you. Any other questions? Senator Erickson-Ropes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Moore, great program. It just makes me wonder if this kind of program is available beyond Ramsey County.
Senator Erickson-Ropes, I don't think so. I think this program is unique to Ramsey County, but I'll tell you, the other day in the Judiciary Committee, Senator Betzel brought a bill to the Judiciary Committee, not for commitment, but for early intervention of pregnant women who need early intervention in order to get the assistance that they need to dry out. And I asked that same question of the physician who came to testify in the committee. And there are not a Mother's First program, but there are other similar intervention programs in other areas, not specifically a Mother's First program. But obviously in this area, we need more of this type of programs. And I think the Mother's First program is a good model that certainly could be adopted elsewhere. But there are other types of programs run by, you know, other areas outside of Ramsey County.
Senator Erickson-Ropes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's great, because I think we all understand if you, you know, front-end the financial support for some of these programs and get to the preventative or early intervention stage of a disease process, it's much better for the families. There's more hope. There's better recovery. It's better for the kids, the whole family. Do they accept people outside Ramsey County into these programs, or do they have to be a Ramsey County resident?
Ms. Haley?
Madam Chair, Senator, it has to be a Ramsey County resident.
Thank you.
And Mr. Haley, do you have a waiting list, or do you...
Turn around again, I'm sorry.
Do you pretty much plan to serve about 100 families per year?
Madam Chair, about 100 families a year. In previous years, it had been about 150, but it's in that category, and we do not have a waiting list.
Okay. Any other questions?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and I just want to thank Senator Mao for carrying this bill. You always do such a great job, and I'm always impressed with you. And I want to just say to I almost said Senator Markey. Well, maybe that's in your future. But I would just say that I am very proud of you, and I think I speak on behalf of all of our senators here that we're so proud of you for getting your life going in the right direction. So I appreciate your testimony.
Thank you very much. I appreciate being here.
Very proud of you. And so with that, Madam Chair, I would move that Senate file 343 as amended be laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill.
Thank you, Senator Coring. And Senator Moe, we'll continue to work with Mr. Haley in trying to sort out the actual dollar amount that you need for the outreach and the aftercare.
Thank you, Senator.
Any further questions? Seeing none, those in favor of Senator Coring's motion that Senate File 343 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill indicate by saying aye.
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 Opposed? The motion is adopted. Okay, then Senator Moe has Senate File 314.
Madam Chair and members, I thank you again for the honor of coming before you to present to you Senate File 314, which is the Senior Nutrition Program Bill. Madam Chair and members, you know, my mother-in-law lives with me, and in my culture, we have a belief that you give birth to your children to take care of you when you're aged. We have a saying that says you grow crops to protect you from hunger, and you give birth to your children to protect you in your old age. And I am especially honored to be the chief author of this bill. And I'm proud to live in a state where I think taking care of our senior citizens is a state goal. You know, in Minnesota Statute Chapter 256.9752, we established the Senior Nutrition Program. And in subdivision of that chapter, we explicitly state that it is the goal of all agencies on aging and senior nutrition programs to support the physical and mental health of seniors living in the community by, one, promoting nutrition programs that serve senior citizens in their homes and communities, and two, providing, within the limit of funds available, the support services that will enable senior citizens to access nutrition programs in the most cost-effective and efficient manner. And in that same chapter, we spell out a number of programs where funds could be allocated to help. And a number of those are transportation of home-delivered meals and purchased goods and medications to the residents of a senior citizen, expansion of home-delivered meals into unserved and underserved areas, transportation to supermarkets or delivery of groceries from supermarkets to homes, vouchers for food purchases at selected restaurants in isolated rural areas, food stamp or food support outreach, transportation of seniors to congregate dining sites, nutrition screening assessments and counseling as needed by individuals with special dietary needs performed by a licensed dietitian or nutritionist, and other appropriate services which support senior nutrition programs, including new service delivery models. In 2003, when this state was experiencing a budget deficit, this program was recommended for total elimination by the governor. And but for the good graces of this committee and Senator Berglund, we were able to preserve some of that funding. But about 15% of the program's dollars were eliminated. Today, Madam Chair and members, we're here to ask for restoration of that funding to where we're at, and we're asking for that restoration to be part of the base. We're also here asking you to help fund a special new outreach program that will provide services to communities with special nutritional needs. And so I am proud and honored, and on behalf of all the senior citizens that I serve, and on behalf of all the volunteers who volunteer on a daily basis to go out to the homes of senior citizens to make sure that they have at least one good meal and companionship throughout the day, I'm proud and honored to present to you Senate File 314 for your consideration. I have with me today a number of individuals who would like to testify on behalf of Senate File 314. I will list them, and I'll just have them speak in order. We have Barb. Is Barb here? Yes. We have Barb Green, who is the director of the White Bear Lake Senior Program and a member of the Senior Services Consortium. We have with us Shep Harris from Jewish Community Relations Council, who will introduce to you one of my favorite people who've been one of my greatest supporters in my advocacy for this program, Zelda Katz, who's a recipient of Meals on Wheels, and then Lynette Peterson, who was here, who is the Southwest Director of Senior Nutrition Programs for Lutheran Social Services.
Madam Chair and committee members, I want to thank you for giving us the opportunity to speak on behalf of Senate File Number 314. My name is Barb Green, and I'm the coordinator of the White Bear Area Senior Program. And we serve homebound seniors in the White Bear Lake Area School District. We serve about 18,000 meals a year to homebound elders and disabled individuals. I also come as a representative from the Senior Services Consortium of Ramsey County. It's a network of 11 Meals on Wheels providers that serve about 1,100 meals a day in Ramsey County, and also a representative of Metro Meals on Wheels, an organization that represents 40 Meals on Wheels programs in the metro area, serving about 1 million meals on wheels every year. Meals on Wheels is really a lifeline for the people who receive this service. For most of these individuals, they want to stay in their home. That's their first choice, is to stay at home. And Meals on Wheels is a vital, vital service for them to stay within their homes. It helps them with providing their primary meal of the day, and in some cases, they split that meal to cover two meals a day. It also gives them that daily contact with the community. That Meals on Wheels deliverer is not just a person bringing a meal, but also a contact with the outside community. For many of these individuals, it's knowing that somebody is coming to see them on a daily basis that helps relieve anxiety that something might happen to them, and no one will notice for a couple of days. But with that Meals on Wheels person delivering, there's a follow-up to make sure that that individual is okay. It also represents a connection with other services. Most people that come onto Meals on Wheels need more than just Meals on Wheels. And by coming onto the program, what they end up doing is they get connected with other services that help them stay in their homes. It costs about $900 a year to provide meals to someone on Meals on Wheels. When you start comparing that to about $60,000 a year for a long-term care facility stay, there's a huge savings. And what we're trying to do is to help people stay in their homes, which is where they want to be, but also to make sure that they are eating properly. There's an enormous cost savings. I figured out that for about $60,000 a year, we can serve about 66 people on Meals on Wheels. I worked with Meals on Wheels programs for about 12 years through 1996 and then left for about 9 years. And I noticed when I came back to Meals on Wheels that we were getting about the same amount of money per meal from federal and state money to cover the cost of the meal. Well, you know what happens in 9 years. Costs go up. And when you end up having the same amount of money per meal, you have to cut somewhere. And so what ends up happening is, you know, you either look for local funding, you cut services, you try and do whatever you possibly can. Well, Meals on Wheels programs have chosen not to cut services. I mean, that's one of the main things that they feel is important, is keeping people in their homes. And so we've had to generate additional funds. Some of that falls on the backs of seniors that are getting the meals. I happen to have a program or work for a program where we have to raise about $17,000 locally. And some of that money comes from the school district. And unfortunately, this past year, we faced a defeat of a school board levy, a school district levy, which means that now we have to find other ways of coming up with these funds. Meals on Wheels has always been recognized as a partnership between federal, state, local governments, as well as the local community. And the restoration of these dollars will help us to continue that partnership and to continue to provide this wonderful service to people who need the service. It'll also give us the opportunity to start looking at other kinds of needs within the community. We're finding more and more people needing weekend meals, more and more people who have special diets, and we've had to really limit that since these funds were cut. And with the restoration of these dollars, we're going to be able to look at those possibilities. In addition to that, with the additional $200,000, we can look at serving a larger population of ethnic seniors. We can also look at expanding services in areas where rural areas where there are a reduction or lack of Meals on Wheels services. And so this bill is something that's very, very important for this program to continue to provide an important service to people living in their homes. Thank you again for having us testify today.
Thank you, Ms. Green. Are there questions for her?
Good morning. My name is Zelda Katz, and I am here to speak about the Kosher Meals on Wheels. You'll have to excuse me. I'm very nervous.
Well, I just say the same thing to you. Don't be nervous now. Just remember that you pay our salaries. So that means that we work for you. And so we're the ones that should be nervous, not you.
I'm 89 years old. I live alone. And I am unable to cook for myself any longer. I receive these Meals on Wheels, and I am very happy. Because, as I said, I can't cook for myself. These meals are very nourishing and very good. Many days it is very difficult for me to go out and get Jewish food, especially during the winter. I depend on this food so I can continue to live independently. Otherwise, I would be forced to move into Sholem Home, and I'm not ready to go yet.
Thank you very much, Ms. Katz, for being here.
I am Jewish, and I abide by our Jewish beliefs. That's why this program is very important to me. Thank you for listening to me, and please consider passing this bill.
Again, thank you for being here. Are there any questions for her? I'm not sure if you have an order you're going in here, so I'll just let you decide who's next. Shep Harris.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Shepard Harris. And I'm representing the Jewish community, which provides a spectrum of human services to 60,000 Minnesotans, Jew and non-Jew alike, on an annual basis. And you just heard a wonderful example from Ms. Katz, who's lovingly referred to as Bubby Katz or Grandma Katz at one of the local synagogues. The kids just
Grandma
love her.
Grandma Zelda. The kids call me.
Grandma Zelda. I stand corrected.
I've never been married, never had no kids of my own, but I became a grandmother, which I'm very proud of.
Thank you. And so with Ms. Katz, with Grandma Zelda, we're here to ask for your support. I just wanted to briefly mention the handout that you have in front of you. It offers a snapshot, particularly from the St. Paul Jewish community, which does provide the Kosher Meals on Wheels to Ms. Katz and to other members of the Jewish community. I also would be remiss if I didn't thank Senator Moa for her leadership and her vigilance on this bill, as we've tried to reinstate the funding cuts a couple of times now. Looking at the handout, you'll see at the bottom of that handout, basically the number of clients and meals have increased significantly since 2002. But then you'll see that in this past year, 24,000 meals, roughly, a little more than 24,000 meals, have been provided to 98 clients. So that demand has actually doubled since 2002. Meanwhile, the funding, if you look at the chart there, has pretty much, the overall funding has decreased by 22%. And that's if you include federal cuts, the state, and even county cuts. In fact, on the county level, back in 2003, The county, unfortunately, cut 50% of the funds that the St. Paul JCC receives to deliver these meals, and that was a direct result of the LGA cuts that were incurred in 2003. So, and just so you know, those cuts are complicated further because kosher meals do cost more. On average, it's about, for the St. Paul JCC, it costs about $2.35. Doesn't sound like a lot, but it costs $2.35 for a kosher meal. That's about 15% higher than the average cost of a non-kosher meal. It doesn't sound like a lot, but it does add up. And so without the increased funding that has come along over the past few years, there have been several senior programs that have been cut significantly or outright eliminated at the JCC. And they have had discussions recently about eliminating the senior congregant dining program as a result of these cuts. So we would encourage your consideration of this. And I just want to add, in terms of the targeted funds section, right now the JCC is only able to provide these kosher meals to senior citizens who live in the Highland Park West 7th area of St. Paul, not even the entire city, just a small portion of the city. So they would like to use this opportunity with these targeted funds to coordinate, whether it's with Metro Meals on Wheels or other entities, to not only serve the St. Paul Jewish community or those who do want the kosher meals, but the entire metro area where the requests have been coming from and increasing. Thank you.
This is to bring the base.
Are there questions? Not then, let's go to Ms. Peterson.
Madam Chairman, and those of you on the committee, my name, well, it's in debate this morning. When I met my husband, he renamed me Lynn, and now I've been going by Lynette, so whichever one you want to call me, I'll respond. But I guess I'm more comfortable after all these years with going by Lynn Peterson. I'm here to represent the nutrition providers of Greater Minnesota. Currently, I am employed by Lutheran Social Service of Minnesota, and I'm overseeing a senior nutrition program for Lutheran Social Service in the southwestern part of the state. This is a new adventure for me as of January 2nd, and we have 22 wonderful rural counties that we are now serving out there. I am here, of course, to speak in favor of Senate file number 314. Personally, I started with senior nutrition probably about the same time as Zelda did. She started being a participant, right?
Right.
Yeah, we shared that earlier. But I started with senior nutrition in 1983. And at that time, my own little community was one of those that had applied for and was awarded senior nutrition services. As I thought about what to share today, it came to me that in that 20-plus years, senior nutrition has come full circle. As the first dining manager for this community, I was amazed to see the impact this program had on the participants, on the community. I'll never forget my first three participants who helped me get things up and running. And I think these three typify our seniors out in rural Minnesota. I had Chester Anderson, a sweet, wonderful bachelor farmer. Eleanor Smith, who was a recent widow. And Margina Steffen, she was the matriarch of the local machinery dealership. As different as these three were, they came together as a team, determined to have services for the seniors of that small community. And it did not take long, and our participation grew to 100 participants on our party days. That was our goal, understanding that this community is only between 600 and 700 people. Back then, we had a young, vibrant senior who was able to come and volunteer. We had a decorating committee. We had an entertainment committee and volunteers to do whatever needed to be done. Chester and many others were no longer lonely. Eleanor blossomed as a volunteer, handling the reservation book, and said to me many times, "I guess I am good for something yet." Margina continued to be the hostess, making sure everyone was welcomed. Well, the years passed. The participants aged, became frail and elderly, and today in that same community, we are serving 13 frail elderly seniors, Meals on Wheels. So a hot meal continues to go into their apartment each day, Monday through Friday. But what is the savings of delaying just these 13 folks from early entry into a nursing home or hospital stays? Of course, there's no way to really put in dollars what this means, but as a wellness program, it certainly is a wise investment. Out in rural Minnesota, we have a little different way of looking at, or a little different type of population, I guess. We used to say if you'd make the Germans and the Norwegians minority, my goodness, we'd have a lot of them. But we are getting minorities. I live in Litchfield, which isn't too far from Wilmer. And just recently, doors have been opening for us to look at serving a minority population there in Wilmer, which is very exciting to us. Delivery of services, of course, is pretty challenging due to the low density of population, lack of resources. We have about 3 seniors per square mile as compared to 9, the state average. At this time, there are services we are unable to provide because of lack of funding. Communities are approaching senior nutrition providers for Meals on Wheels as well as congregate services because their communities no longer have a grocery store. They no longer have a restaurant. Additional funding, we could go into several additional apartment complexes with congregate dining. Probably in the short time that I've been back with nutrition, with Lutheran Social Service, more than anything I have heard that we need another and a better way to bring meals into the true rural Minnesota. That is when we have, just had a call the other day from one of the counties, we have an elderly couple out in about 10 miles out. Is there some way we can get them a hot meal every day? Well, we certainly would provide that hot meal. And we do rely on our volunteers to deliver meals within communities, but for them to drive that far is pretty difficult to find people to do that. The next day I had another call for another rural community. The meals we certainly can provide, the transportation to get them there is getting a little more and more tricky. I'm happy to say that we have successfully met some of these challenges by working with faith and action groups in our local communities. A huge growth in that rural area means frozen meals. Perhaps we can get them a hot meal and 4 frozen for the 5-day service, or 6, depending upon the number of days that they would like to have service. But in order to do this, we need to update our kitchens. I'm afraid in many cases, the refrigeration, the kitchens, the equipment in the kitchens have been around as long as I have, and we need trucks to deliver. Keep in mind that 70% of the communities in the most western part of the state are less than 500 people. Please look carefully at increasing our funding back to the rates prior to 2003 cuts and make dollars available to update our equipment to better meet today's needs. And I thank you.
Are there questions for Ms. Peterson? Any other questions for the author? If not, then Senator Pretner-Solon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would move that Senate File 314 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you for that motion. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted, and we'll send you back to the Tax Committee to get us some money, Senator Moore, so we can fund these wonderful bills. LG.